From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch the show on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. If you live on the East Coast, especially the Southeast, this year's hurricane season may have you rethinking your emergency preparedness plan. If you live on the West Coast, the massive and deadly earthquakes in Mexico may be inspiring similar thoughts. Anywhere else, extreme weather conditions in our increasingly warming planet should prompt you to be prepared. Survivalism is no longer an issue just for doomsday preppers. Survival skills and equipment are more necessary than ever in this new normal that we live in. And so today we turn to Matthew Stein. He is the author of When Technology Fails, a manual for self-reliance, sustainability, and surviving the long emergency, as well as When Disaster Strikes, a comprehensive guide for emergency planning and crisis survival. Welcome to the program, Matthew.
Well, thank you, Sonali. It's a pleasure to be here with you today.
Now, as I was watching the hurricanes play out and seeing the images of people in these huge floods, seeing the images from Mexico, I naturally thought about my own plan. And I think a lot of Americans were thinking, you know, what would I do in the situation? What should I do ahead of time so that I might be better equipped to handle this sort of disaster? How do you make the case to Americans that it's not just, you know, an unrealistic fear anymore that the disaster could strike, but really something that is becoming more normal?
Well, given the new normal, I'd say everybody and their brother should be prepared for emergencies. And between climate change, we saw massive hurricanes and we've seen earthquakes. So a lot of people say, well, I don't live in hurricane area. I don't live in an earthquake area. So why should I need to be worried about it? But the fact of the matter is that we live in the electronic age. And when the grid goes down, as we see in Puerto Rico, people are totally messed up. You know, without the grid, they have no water, they have no sewage, they have no smartphones, they have no access to cash, they have no access to gasoline pumps, nothing works when the grid goes down. And unfortunately, we're threatened not just by climate change, but we have things called extreme solar storms that come along once in every 8 decades. And the fact of the matter is, it's been 9.5 decades since the last extreme event in 1921, and it was only 6 decades before that to the 1859 Carrington event. And our grid has an Achilles heel. It didn't exist. That technology just simply wasn't invented till 60 or 70 years after the last extreme solar event. So we're totally unprepared for that. And given all of these, it just makes sense that we have the insurance of an emergency backup plan and emergency supplies and emergency preparedness. And it's like car insurance. No one buys car insurance and wants to get in a wreck. You know, we buy car insurance and we hope we never get in a wreck. But if that day happens, we thank God we have the insurance.
So let's talk about what some of the basic things are that everybody can and should have with them or learn how to do before we get into some things that you might try to do if you really want to, you know, become an expert with the issue of survivalism. I'm in Southern California, and we live with the constant threat of earthquakes here, and seeing what unfolded in Mexico recently really reminded a lot of people they need to get their earthquake kit in order. So earthquake kit is your very basic thing that everybody should have, right? But you write in your book that one of the most important things that people sort of tend to not realize is so important is clean drinking water. How central is the issue of having a supply of clean drinking water?
Well, having a supply is one thing, and being able to purify water on the fly is another thing.
Right.
So every emergency kit should have some stored water, but you should also have the ability to purify water. Now, water is so incredibly important that in my kits, I like to have multiple things for water. So for instance, I'll have a backcountry filter, like a K-9 or MSR filter, where you can pump the water through, and it's got a carbon core and a ceramic outside cartridge in there so that it's field serviceable, meaning that if you put it into some scummy green ditch, and you pump through and it plugs up your filter. You can take it apart and you can scrub it down and you can put it back together and it still works again. Whereas a lot of the filters, you plug them up once and you got to throw them out. And, you know, that's fine when you got a whole bunch of them or you can go to the store. But in an emergency, you really want something that's field serviceable that you can take apart, clean, put back together again, and you're in business. Then I also have like things like a SteriPen is great. It's a little UV sterilizer for drinking water. You get about 400 quarts out of a single battery, set of batteries in there, double A batteries. And some Clorox bleach, having a bottle of Clorox bleach will purify thousands of gallons of water.
Wait a minute, let's stop bleach. On that for a minute. A bottle of Clorox bleach, but you know, when we think of bleach, we think of poison. Why would we keep bleach with us, and how do you use that to purify water?
Well, it's got to be plain old Clorox-type bleach, not bleach with softeners or perfumes or anything else in it. And yeah, bleach is poison, but 4 drops of bleach in a quart of water will kill the bad bugs and bacteria in there and viruses. Now, there's a caveat on that. Like bleach will not get rid of Cryptosporidium, and that's a really nasty bug. And the spores from Cryptosporidium, the cysts, can survive full Clorox bleach. In other words, 500,000 people got sickened in something like 1996 in Milwaukee when there was a huge spring runoff and millions and millions of these cysts of these little single-celled protozoa got into the public water system, and the chlorine in the water system didn't kill them all. And 112 adults died. Wow. 112 people died, and 500,000 people got sick. And so Clorox bleach is really good for your run-of-the-mill bacteria and viruses, the most common things, but it's not good for everything. Whereas like that filter will definitely get rid of those cysts, no problem, and the UV light will too. But the UV light, if it's scummy green water, all bets are off because the bugs will hide behind the scum. And if you dip your SteriPen in there, you know, like if you've seen the movie Men in Black, he pulls the pen out, puts his sunglasses on, clicks it, and the flashy thing goes off, and everybody's memory's gone. Well, you pull your SteriPen out, and you flip it upside down, you stick it in your bottle, and you click it, and the blue light goes off, and you stir it around for about 15 seconds while the light's going off. And then you can drink your bottle right then. No
pumping, and that zaps the problems. The bacteria, yeah. If you will.
Right, it zaps them. But if it's scummy water, then you know some of those bugs will hide behind the scum, and it's, all bets are off. Water is so important. See, in 1984, when my daughter was 3 months old, I did my last big wall on El Capitan in Yosemite, and it was Memorial Day weekend, and it was record-breaking heat. It was like 110 on the wall in the afternoons. And we brought 2 quarts a day per person, which isn't very much. It was kind of the standard weight when you're trying to haul it all up yourself, and you know, it's heavy. And we totally ran out of water. By breakfast, we could have drunk all the water we had for day 3. We could have drunk it at breakfast and been thirsty. We made it last through half the day, but it was just horrible. And I promise you, if you're as thirsty as I was on that day, all you've got is scummy, gross ditch water to drink. You'll drink it. I mean, there's no way you'll be able to stop yourself from drinking it. It was that terrible. My tongue would stick to my roof of my mouth when I tried to talk, and I'd start gagging and retching. My mouth was cracked. My lips were cracked and bleeding. I mean, it was just horrible. And if you're in that situation, you'll drink the scum if that's all you got. And hopefully you've got the tools to purify that scummy green ditch water so that you're not explaining to your family and your wife and your kids or your husband why, you know, you weren't prepared and now they've got diarrhea and they're vomiting because they drank some ditch water that made themselves horribly ill.
Let's talk about food and being able to prepare food. You've got a whole section in your book, When Disaster Strikes, on the sort of various kinds of camping stoves you might have, but also on building your own fire, which is a great skill. How important is it to have some kind of plan, a store of wood, or just to have these kinds of camping stoves? Storing propane is also something that you have to do very carefully, right? I mean, you can't, propane is something that's extremely flammable.
Well, propane is pretty easy to store because it's got those nice little steel canisters around it. So it's quite easy and quite safe.
Those are really hardy. You can't really damage those even. Yeah. Okay.
Pretty tough. I mean, in an earthquake, if bricks fall on them, yeah, then your propane tanks will probably be gone. So it's helpful to have a stove, a little backcountry stove, like a multi-fuel stove, like the MSR ones. And both on my website, whentechfails.com, and the article Building the Ultimate Survival Kit, and in my books, When Disaster Strikes and When Technology Fails, I give recommendations for gear. I don't sell any of that stuff directly, but I tell people, hey, this is like the backcountry standard, and I've been a mountaineer and a rock climber and an extreme backcountry kind of person. So what you want is the stuff that people rely on in Nepal and India and in Antarctica and places like that, where, you know, or Tibet, where, you know, the Himalayas, where you can't just go to the store and buy that stuff. It's got to be really reliable. And that's the kind of things you want to have on hand just in case.
Right. And this was another interesting thing. You basically you point out in this book a lot of the things that you could either buy at a camping store, so things that you would need on a trip where you're going to be somewhere remote, or the kinds of things that people in developing nations rely on because they may not live in a city with an electrical grid or gas lines going in. So they have to be using this kind of technology that is more individualistic and self-reliant, some of which may or may not even be available in the United States. So let's talk about the skills that one can get and one really should have, which I thought was one of the best parts of your book also, which is just basic survival skills like, say, building a fire. And I want to get to the health stuff too, you know, how to manage somebody who's just been injured. But what about building a fire? We imagine that if you keep a set of matches in your earthquake kit, that might be good enough, but is it?
Well, matches are really helpful. And again, like fire and water, those are such important things. I like to have multiples. So a little magnesium.
You have to have the mindset of a hunter-gatherer, right?
Yeah, right. So in small, compact, like Bic lighters. I mean, when things fall apart, Bic lighters would be in like great demand. I mean, try if you've ever tried, if you build a fire like with a fire drill, where you're basically like rubbing sticks together, only you're doing it with a string and a bow that spins it really fast. If you do it just right and everything is perfectly dry and you've made it just right, you can do that in a surprisingly fast period of time, like 5 minutes, once all of your stuff is made. But if anything's at all wet and things aren't at all perfect, you're not going to get the fire built. Whereas if you have a Bic lighter, and if you've got some tinder, you know, if you got a little bit of white gas you can pour on something, then it doesn't take a genius and it doesn't take an extreme survival expert to make a fire with conditions like that, even if things are wet and not perfect. So it's nice to develop the skills for doing it the old-fashioned way, like everything's gone, you have no matches, you have no lighters, you have nothing. And it's also nice to have those cool little gadgets to make your life a whole lot easier than doing it the old way. I mean, the old way was so important. It was so difficult that people would wrap coals and carry them with them so they could start another fire somewhere else.
Wow, like live hot coals?
Yeah, you got it. It's like it's like preserving fire once you got it going was a really big deal, you know, especially if things were wet. And, you know, again, a fire drill works remarkably well if you know what you're doing, have all the right materials and conditions are perfect. But they're rarely like that.
And do you lay out in your book all of those details, how to make a fire drill, et cetera?
I do. And there's magnesium fire starters. I tell you, a magnesium fire starter, where you scrape off little magnesium shavings and you put a spark, that's so much easier than a flint and steel, and it's still not easy.
Wow.
So it's like give yourself a couple of tools. Don't count on, oh, you know, I saw in some book somewhere how to do a fire drill, and if everything happens, I'll just make one of those. It's like if you haven't practiced and haven't done it under good conditions, you're going to be SOL when you know, if you're out needing to do it and the conditions are less than optimal, you're going to have a really hard time. So those things are so important. And things like having some backup food, having medicines. I mean, What does someone with type 2 diabetes do when there's no pharmacies, there's no deliveries, there's no nothing? If you don't have some backup supplies on hand, you're counting on that pharmacy always being there in a place like Puerto Rico. Now, Puerto Rico is a microcosm for the entire United States when the next extreme solar event happens. Now, there is stuff that our government...
Because their entire electrical grid got knocked out. Yeah.
Right. There is stuff that our government can do to prevent kind of the apocalypse now sort of situation. But so far, they've refused to do it. It's for the price of a single B-2 bomber, $2 to $3 billion. We couldn't prevent all the bad stuff from happening, but we could prevent the entire grid from collapsing from many months to several years. And we could do that for the price of a single B-2 bomber. And so far, they've been talking about it, but not doing it. It's kind of like for 50 years, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers warned that it wasn't a question of if the levees around New Orleans would fail, but when would they fail? They said, when the next Category 3 or stronger hurricane hits, these levees will fail.
Hindsight is always 2020, isn't it?
That was foresight. That was foresight. For 50 years, they said that, and the government's always... In fact, at one point, they approved the money to fix the levees, and they shuttled it into something else. You know, it's much sexier to have a new sports arena than to fix levees, which didn't appear to be broken. To the average person would look and say, oh, the levees work just fine. Why do we need to fix them? People are looking at the grid. Same kind of attitude. Ah, the grid's fine. You know, it goes down for a little bit here and there, but never long term. Everything's okay. The fact of the matter is the scientists are saying the next extreme solar event hits, this grid's down and for a long, long, long time. And we can fix it. We have the technology to fix it, but it requires a couple $1 billion and someone has to spend that money.
Wow.
And so far, they're not doing it.
You know, the scenes from Las Vegas after the mass shooting also reminded me of the kinds of basic first aid skills that all of us can and should have. And your book discusses those as well. Let's talk a little bit about that, learning some of these basic skills. I mean, taking a CPR class, of course, could really help in terms of learning math resuscitation, the Heimlich maneuver. But you also talk about, like, if somebody's bleeding, which could happen, you know, in a mass shooting, it could happen.
Sure.
If you have an earthquake and or a hurricane and something falls on you, and so tell me a little bit about the kinds of things that we need to know to do things, basic things like stopping somebody from bleeding out while you're waiting for emergency vehicles to come.
Well, I highly recommend that everyone take an advanced first aid and CPR class. They're usually combined together. Now, both of my books have basically an advanced first aid manual built into an entire chapter in each of my books. So one of the things you can do is there's, you know, right here in your arm, you can press the vein or the artery against the bone and shut off blood to the arm.
Underside of your upper arm that you're showing.
Yeah, okay. The brachial artery. You can push right there and you push the artery against the bone and it shuts off the blood supply. Similarly, there's a femoral artery where you can push against like the junction between your thigh and your pelvis and you can shut off the blood. Then there's the traditional constriction, where a tourniquet, where you put a strap around and then you put a stick through and you twist it to tie it off. And then you try to loosen that. Depending on how severe the bleeding is, you can loosen it and let a little blood in so that the flesh doesn't die. Now, sometimes it's so severe that you say, well, you're going to lose your leg, but it's better than losing your life. Now, other times you can loosen the tourniquet and let some blood back through and then tighten it again so that at least the flesh doesn't die and you don't kill the leg. So,
okay,
you
know, I'm feeling queasy just like hearing you talk about this.
I've never had to use CPR, but a friend of mine kept the National Geographic Man of the Year, who does the Himalayan Eye Project, where he goes around Africa and the Himalayas and replaces corneas, and he does, like, you know, 50 people a day. He restores their eyesight. My buddy was a first year medical student at Harvard Med along with him, and they skipped class their first day of medical school, went bouldering, rock climbing, and he flipped over backwards and smacked his head and went into cardiac arrest. And my friend, who's now Dr. Hansel Stedman, kept him alive for 45 minutes with CPR. Now, I've never had to do that, But I have had to deal with people with skull fractures and severe bleeding. And so my first aid skills, and I also helped a little girl save her severed finger on a playground. And the surgeons were able to reattach the finger. And knowing wow. those skills, I was able to preserve the finger and rush her to, you know, to the emergency room, and they were able to reattach her finger. Mm-hmm. So these skills have come in very, very helpful in my life so far. And, hopefully, you never know what's going to happen, but I highly recommend that people take the class and then having the manual, because, you know, you might have taken the class years ago, having the manual there with you can help refresh your memory. Like, how do I do that again? You look it up, and there's great illustrations and great instructions, and it's like, oh, yeah, that's what I do, and it's this many compressions and this fast, and then these, you know, two breaths, and then these 10 compressions, that kind of thing. The manual is very helpful to refresh your memory if you've been a while since you've had the class.
It seems to me, Matthew, that the book, When Disaster Strikes, is a great thing to help you prepare for disaster, but then should also be part of your kit, that when you are in that position where you suddenly need those skills, it's there as a sort of an encyclopedia manual to help you deal with things as they come about, right? So both a preparation guide and a how-to guide at the very moment of need.
Right. It's a great guide for prepping, and it can guide you through all the steps. So you could start out very easy with the 72-hour kit. How do I deal with, you know, food, medicine, shelter for the first 3 days in a disaster? Building up to maybe I want to store a few weeks of food, to have 6 months of food, to maybe a year. And then the other half of it is, how do I survive in the event of a disaster? What are my best strategies? What things do I do? How do I do solar disinfection, for instance? One of the first things, if things really fell apart, I'd go dumpster diving, get a whole bunch of cast-off water bottles, because you can take those water bottles out. And if you lay them in the sun for 6 hours, the UV rays from the sun, direct sunlight, will purify the water. It'll kill all the bugs inside the water bottle.
Wow, just empty plastic water bottles. Huh.
Empty plastic water bottles. It's called SODIS, S-O-D-I-S, for solar disinfection. And you could make a sand filter. So all of that information's there of both, you know, how do I prepare ahead of time? And then if things happen, how do I survive? How do I cope? How do I manage? And even if, and it gives you everything from, like, if you've got the high-tech tools ahead of time, great. But maybe they all went away in the disaster, or maybe you never had them to begin with. So if you've got nothing, how do you pull yourself up by your bootstraps and make it through that disaster? And how do you care for and defend and help your family through that disaster?
Since we are an earthquake country, Matthew, we hear these things in the news or the memes that go viral about the kinds of things that you should do in your earthquake. And I know you have a little bit in your book about the triangle of life versus duck cover. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Sure.
Say an earthquake hits in the next 10 minutes. What would you suggest I do?
Well, I'm going to say that there are guidelines for survival, but no rules for survival. Mm. So, like in Mexico, so a lot of the quote experts say, well, duck, hold on, and cover is the proper way to do it. But in Mexico, the people who heard the sirens and had time to get out, they survived when a lot of those buildings collapsed. And other people survived who happened to be in the quote triangle of life, meaning that they're stuck in a building, but they were next to a couch, or they were next to a vertical wall, or they're next to a, you know, something very substantial that could hold things up, like a refrigerator, so that when things collapsed, there was something that gave them a gap of space to be in there. So I'm going to say that in the crisis, there's a built-in survival mechanism in human beings that Mother Nature built into us. It's like our spiritual DNA has it inside of us. And those who didn't have it in the past got eaten by the saber-toothed tigers or killed in the battlefield. And that is that gut instinct that will tell you, like, do this. So maybe duck, cover, and hold on is right in your situation. And maybe rolling, because if it's really severe, like I talked to a guy, in my first earthquake in California in 77 at Plantronics, and I came from Vermont, first earthquake I felt my desk bumping into my leg, and I looked up and saw the light shaking, and I sprinted for the door. And everybody else kind of looked up at the lights and was like, oh, earthquake, and then went back to their work. And the only other guy who went out the door had been in the massive 9-point earthquake in Chile in like 1964. And he said that was so strong that wherever you were was where you were. He said you just knocked off your feet. All you could do was crawl or roll. You couldn't stand up. You'd be knocked down totally. And so he and I were the only two who ran out of that building on that day. Now, so in a severe earthquake, you may not be able to run. You may not be able to move other than rolling and crawling. And so your best bet in that situation might be to just get next to a vertical wall, something to provide structure to give you a space that if things collapse around you, hopefully you'll be in a space that you'll survive. Other cases, if you can get outside, get outside. You know, there is no one rule. Holding on, in many cases, the most damage is done from broken glass, flying objects, and being thrown around, in which case, duck, cover, and hold on might be your best bet. So again, that's where that inner guidance system is so important, because at that moment, maybe duck, cover, and hold on is right. Maybe the triangle of life is right. Maybe getting out that door as fast as you can.
Right. Each situation is different. Finally, Matthew, what about after sort of the kind of rebuilding part of when disaster strikes? Say the emergency is over. For example, a lot of the folks in Florida, in Puerto Rico, in Houston are dealing with the effects of the aftermaths of flooding. Your book, does it also provide a guide for how to kind of deal with that, you know, when everything calms down, like what to do if mold appears?
Yeah, well, I definitely talk about mold. Mold is kind of like the flooding's evil twin. And I went through that situation. Actually, mold eventually, it made my wife very ill and nearly killed her. So I learned about mold the hard way. So I've got a lot of very practical advice on mold. And in fact, one of the side effects of the black mold Stachybotrys that nearly killed her was cancer. And 8 years later, she died of cancer. So
cancer was a side effect of toxic black mold?
That's correct.
Wow.
It's a side effect
goodness.
Of toxic black mold. And so whether it's, you know, you can't prove the mold killed her, but she was extremely healthy, ate well, until the mold nailed her the first time, and then she had a compromised immune system, and so things were tough. You know, she was functional most of the time in the 7 years between the mold and then and coming down with cancer, but she had health struggles during that entire period. Though most of the time, to most people, she'd look healthy. So staying healthy in the aftermath is extremely important, and that's why I devote entire chapters to that in both books, because often in a major, major disaster, like happens in Puerto Rico now, disease can be really rampant afterwards, and that's where having backup alternatives like colloidal silver generators, like having a stock of antibiotics, like having miracle mineral supplements, you know, a variety of things, homeopathy. The shotgun approach is good because you don't necessarily know what's going to work. And I've never seen an alternate or an antibiotic work in all situations. So having multiples on hand is very, very helpful. In case one thing's not working, you can try something else.
Also, you know, if you were planning on starting your exercise regimen someday in the future, now is the time to start, because one of the things that we find when disaster strikes is just being strong and healthy is going to help, right? I mean, just kind of living our day-to-day lives in a way that keeps our bodies healthy is something that comes in handy when, and also, of course, provides us with longevity, which we all want.
Yes, I totally agree with you on that. Being healthy, and please don't put off things like dental work. You know, something that, you know, you figure the doctors are always going to be there. The medicines are always going to be there. And we can see from this preview with Puerto Rico, that's like a preview. Unless our government fixes this Achilles heel in our grid, that's a preview of not an if event, but a when event. That's a guaranteed statistical average. Every 8 decades, we're 15 years overdue for the next one. It could be 500 years.
This is the solar storm you were talking about, which I confess I had not really even thought about.
Statistically, it's not. It's an 80-year event, and we've been 95 years from the last one. So, you know, the next one could be next month. It could be in 20 years. It could be in 50 years. But statistically, we're overdue. So it's not a question of if, but when. And so you know, that's enough impetus right there. Even if you feel like you're not particularly in a bad earthquake area, that's not enough impetus right there. And certainly most all of California is enough of an earthquake area that if a big one strikes, the infrastructure could be taxed for a long, long period of time.
Well, Matthew, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Your book, I'm sure, is available where in bookstores and et cetera. Is there a website that you'd like to give out?
Sure. You've got a lot of great free information. And if you want a signed copy, you can get that. That's like the only thing I sell actually on my websites at whentechfails.com, short for my larger book, When Technology Fails. And people say, well, why would I get When Disaster Strikes? For prepping and survival, that's much more narrow focus than When Disaster Strikes. It's just like the perfect handbook for that. And so whentechfails.com, lots of great free information under articles, grab-and-go kits, purifying water, handy alternative meds and herbs to have on hand. Highly recommend you check out the free articles on the website.
We'll post a link to that from our site later today. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure, and thanks for having me on today.
My guest is Matthew Stein. He is the author of When Technology Fails, a manual for self-reliance, sustainability, and surviving the long emergency. He is also the author of When Disaster Strikes, a comprehensive guide for emergency planning and crisis survival, which we were discussing today. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.